Okay, so in the morning session, we discussed the six general faults of samsara, or general faults of being reborn in the wheel of life in any of the types of rebirth. And then now we move on to the second outline, which is discussing the particular or specific problems experienced in a human rebirth, many of which we've already mentioned, so we can go through them relatively quickly. As we do so, you're welcome to ask any questions, or if you have any now, and don't be shy about putting your hand up if you have something you wanted to clarify or comment upon. Yeah.
But
the shopping mall comes and what, shoots people or something?
I just use that as an example, but I'm wondering, is anything random that happens to you?
Yeah. Well, well, that addition that happens to you, that changes the question. Is anything random?
Okay.
The first part of the question, is anything random? Well, His Holiness the Dalai Lama often talks, particularly in discussions with Western scientists and Western audiences. He clearly explained that there are two types of cause and effect which bring about events, experiences. One he calls the natural cause and effect sequence. For example, he gives the physical properties and chemical activity of the elements. An example is, why does this leaf fall off the tree before that leaf? And he said, that is a cause and effect relationship in terms of the qualities, the physical qualities of the tree, and it's not karma. And there is no, there is a cause. There always is a cause, but in that case, it's chemico-physical. The second cause and effect is relationship between our actions and our results, which overall is called karmic cause and effect. So, this brings in the second part of the question, anything which happens to the individual. Is there anything random which might happen to the individual? So His Holiness in these talks, he says that when it comes down to actually experiencing pleasure or pain or happiness or unhappiness, you know, physical pleasure or physical pain or mental unhappiness, his words are undoubtedly karmic cause and effect is involved. It may well be a random external environmental occurrence. Like, again, he gives an example. He says, during a talk, he was giving in Dharamsala and there was a very cold spell of weather. And he said that the winds and the currents, etc., coming from the Bay of Bengal and India, etc., are the physico-chemical causes behind it, the cold weather. But when it comes down to the individual, the experience can be quite different. Some individuals can be very displeased by the bad weather. Some can not care. Others can be quite happy. Rain, snow, whatever. So there's an interrelationship, he talks about, between the natural cause and effect and the karmic cause and effect. Something totally random, well, he doesn't mention that. I mean, when we think about logically, nothing can occur without a cause. In terms of our lives, of the world, the environment, there is a sequence of cause and effect, and results or effects become causes in their own right because they were produced in dependence upon changing causes and conditions. And so results have the quality of change. And change is the defining characteristic of cause-effect relationship. The causes necessarily change in bringing about their result or their effect. So, I can't think of a random, any effect or any result which has no cause. Can you?
But so I was thinking about a school shooting, right? So there's an unhappy kid and he goes in and he just opens up. Is that random?
A which? What was the example?
A school shooting.
School?
Shooting.
Oh, yeah.
With a gun.
Oh, yeah.
So you happen to be in a place where this person goes crazy. Is it random that you're there? Or... you're there for a reason, but then you weren't there to get killed.
Right.
So is that random?
The death of the person, Buddhism would say, there is a result, there is a suffering experience, and that is undoubtedly, in His Holiness's words, related to karmic cause and effect. Yes, what we ascribe to bad luck is more to it.
So it doesn't seem like that's random. So what you're saying is that person's karma ripened, so they would experience that suffering, correct?
The karma ripened with the experience of pain and death. It does not imply that it was predestined to happen. It's just the combination of causes and conditions which bring us into certain situations. Is that like earlier this morning we said birth is the cause of death? So the mere fact that we have a human body, which is a karmic result, the human body is very fragile, but because it's a human body. If, for example, we had the body, say, of a divine being which is made of light, which cannot be harmed by a solid bullet. I mean, I know it's a great example, but the very fact that we're human is that we are liable to be injured or killed by things which kill humans. So there's a bit of distance between the cause and the effect. But definitely, in the case of a crazy person shooting at random, the individual is shooting at random, but whether the bullet hits me, there is an element of my karma involved in that experience. All right. Now, good question to think about. Okay. So the particular suffering experienced by humans, this is given in detail Because as you know, in the graduated path to enlightenment, meditators who are at this stage of the practicing the path, they have to overcome to their desire that when we die, that we're reborn human again, human or a divine being, that we don't get reborn as an animal or in a more suffering experience. So we have to overcome our belief that the best goal in life is to avoid going to hell or having a horrible rebirth, and to at least be reborn as a human or in a heaven. That human and heaven rebirths have their problems, and we have to overcome the attachment to that. So the list that we've given you is the sufferings, the 8 specific sufferings experienced by humans is thinking about birth. So before lunch we talked about the pain of being born for the baby. And not only is there the immediate difficulty of being born, but this new human body and this human mind possess the potentials for pain and problems to come one after the other throughout life. There's no way we can avoid the difficulties of sickness, of environmental extreme exposure, aging and death. So birth, each newborn birth is the source of the sufferings of sickness, aging and death. They're the main sufferings of human beings. Not only, it's the source of the sufferings because birth is the source of the causes of suffering. So each newborn baby's mind is not a clean sheet. It carries with it the unripened karmic potencies from past lives, which are born on the subtle mind, as well as the seeds of disturbing emotions and positive emotions as well, constructive emotions. And of course, with the karmic potencies, virtuous potencies, which bring about happiness in that life. So we don't know, all newborn babies look pretty much equal to us, but we know that their bodies will, according to their genetic inheritance, will grow up different shapes, different types of bodies, some conventionally more attractive than others, some conventionally less attractive, and so on, the whole spectrum. But also the mind of the baby has the sources of the karmic potencies and the seeds of the afflictions, selfishness, ignorance, anger, attachment, and so on. So we should be aware of that. And we don't know how this new child will grow up, what sort of mind they will have. If we're unaware of the inheritance of karma and disturbing emotions, so we do assume that the baby's mind is a clean slate, and that anything goes wrong with the developing child and an adult, then it's the parents' fault, society's fault. It's the problems must be external, and this engenders a lot of guilt and suffering in the minds of parents, a lot of anger and aggression towards society, and even the developing person experiences a lot of unhappiness and misery, and they don't know that they're experiencing the results of the past karma. So the developing child and the new adult blames the parents, blames society. So you have all this blame going out. But there is inherent in our mind these sources of suffering. Of course, once in, you know, we talk about personality being a result of nature and nurture, and indeed, there are genetic inheritances which do have an impact on the psychological status of the new person. They are without doubt the nurture, you know, the way a person grows up, the experiences that they've had, and the way they're treated, and so on. Of course, these are important conditions in what sort of mental state they grow into, or that they cultivated during their life. So awareness of karma and disturbing emotions adds a third variable to the equation of how our personalities develop, in what aspect they develop. The final point about birth is that it is the beginning of unwanted separation from all the things that we're going to come to love and desire and enjoy throughout our life. Maybe, you know, of course the first one is usually the mother. But when we're 4 or 5 years old, the first day at school is very often the first day of separation from mother. And it's sort of like a classical thing. Not invariably so, but if the mother is also experiencing trauma of taking the child to the school gates and then saying goodbye, and the child's crying. Of course, it's not always like that. Sometimes children are very happy to get away from mum. But you know what I mean. Throughout life, we're going to love and lose. Incredible joy of the loving and the happiness. Incredible sadness at the loss. We're set up for it. Reality. Okay. Aging. Second problem. We begin to age, well, even from the time we were conceived. You know, we're conceived with a karmically determined lifespan. So our lifespan begins to shorten from the moment we're conceived, and it's variable for each individual. So aging in terms of our lifespan, aging in terms of the deterioration of our body, and consequently the deterioration of our body, our brain, our nervous system, and so on, leads to deterioration in our mental capacity. Which the mind itself does not age. I've never heard any presentation of mind experiencing in itself the degeneration of its qualities. Certainly we lose memory, etc. We lose intelligence as we get older, we start to age and become. And you know, the loss of memory and intelligence can be extreme in case of dementia. But I think that this is purely dependent or a result of change in our brain, in our nervous system. Mind itself is the continuum of consciousness, and it does not age. In fact, you know, it's constantly changing, and indeed, we can maybe be taught correct things and then be influenced by others, say, oh, that's rubbish, this is the way it is. And so our knowledge of factual knowledge or correct knowledge can become incorrect. It can be false understandings. That sort of change can happen, but I wouldn't ascribe to that the term aging. Okay, so these particular aspects of aging, which are inevitable in every human life, as we get older, there's loss of our, you know, our physical beauty, our health, physical health, loss of our physical strength and vitality, and particularly as in old age, there's weakening of our senses. We can know we can't see as well as we can see, we can't hear as well. I know that very well, which I'm experiencing right now. Our muscles are not as strong. We can't do what we used to do. Our ability to enjoy sense experiences diminishes with age. And as our life passes, then death is always approaching. So that process we are experiencing at the present moment, and it can only accelerate with the passing of each year. I think, as I mentioned before, there was a birthday celebration was arranged for this Holiness of the Dalai Lama in San Francisco. It might have been Los Angeles, I can't remember. But anyway, big audience, he's giving a talk. What's the big deal with a birthday? It's just another year closer to death, getting older and aging. No big deal. Sickness, right? Nobody is free from sickness. When it occurs, there's loss of power and control over our bodily functions. A lot of pain, physical pain, and mental despair. These increase in chronic illnesses. They can be constantly present. And we've all seen, young people, attractive, vital, on top of the world. And then I'm thinking of people I've known who've contracted things like chronic illnesses like rheumatoid arthritis. And over the years, it only gets worse, and the body becomes incredibly twisted and distorted and constantly painful, difficult to walk even. So sad. And I've seen beautiful young people transform over the years with chronic illnesses. We can't say it's not going to happen to us. With sickness, we lose our desire for enjoyments. We're forced to experience unpleasant medical treatment, surgery, and there are restrictions on our behavior, what we can do. And with sickness, we know, again, our life is ending. And the fourth problem is death itself. So, the main problems with dying. So we're separating from all of the attractive and enjoyable possessions, our friends, our companions. We're separating from this own body, which we've cherished and looked after so much. So the main problem is we're losing all that we've lived for, and we'll never see or enjoy those friends and those experiences again. Now, at the actual time of death, there is so much unhappiness can occur, so much pain and misery by what is actually causing our death to occur. So much so, many people, more and more frequently now, are choosing to voluntarily end their life in order to avoid those last painful days, weeks, months, or even years. The next step is that throughout life, we're constantly experiencing the unhappiness of being parted from what we like, from things which give us pleasure and things we've striven to achieve and be protected and happy. The examples in the text, like our teachers, our family, our friends, our possessions. It's like the suffering of a person who's been condemned to be locked up in jail. Then without choice. They're separated from all of the people, and possessions, and situations that they enjoy. So, it's not as severe as that, but throughout life, we are being separated from those things we enjoy, and we can't recreate the situations. So we live in memories, pining for the good times, for the old times. And in our pining for things which have passed away into the past, or for friends who have died, or for possessions which we've lost, then we can fall into depression and just really, you know, angry, upset. We can't enjoy anything now, and we're depressed. And the more we think about the good things that we've lost, the more unhappy and sad we become. And this happens. I mean, you know, it's true. We know from our experience and those around us, we can see it happening. This is the human lot in life. Not only are we experiencing the problem of being separated from the things we enjoy, but we humans are constantly being forced into situations that they don't want, meeting what they don't like. You have any classic examples of what is happening now with the spread of this virus around the world. The two cruise ships, thousands of passengers, and people, no choice. You're locked up in your cabin, not even a porthole to let in fresh air, and you're stuck there. Nobody will allow the ship to dock and the people to go off the ship. And you wonder how bad it's going to get. They say 2 weeks, but during those 2 weeks, you're being exposed to people with a virus. So when does your two-week period end? You can't say. You can't say that after 2 weeks everybody can leave the ship. So anyway, you know the situation. It's horrible. So there are lots of things that we don't like. People. You know, enemies. I hate that person. So even hearing the name of somebody we don't like keeps coming up, and that makes us feel bad, unhappy. And of course, if we actually do meet them, then it's even worse. So we are populating our environment, not just with people, but with insects and snakes, whatever, animals that we don't like. We're populating our environment with situations we don't like. Extreme heat, extreme cold, or whatever it is. There are many situations and things which we dislike. So we're constantly encountering them. We don't realize, of course, that our actual enemy, the real enemy, is inside. That which causes us suffering is our anger, our very discrimination to things as being bad and being hostile towards things and situations. That subjective hostility, that's the real enemy. That's what makes us unhappy. This person was no problem, was probably my friend or a total stranger, no problem. It was when I decided I don't like that person. That person's awful. I hate that person. From that moment on, the person became a condition for our unhappiness. But the cause of the unhappiness was our own discrimination of anger, hostility. In these bad situations, we live in constant fear that harmful things will happen to us. Enemies will hurt us, or the weather will be bad, or the earthquake will come, or whatever. I have a friend in Kathmandu. I had lunch with last time I was in Nepal a long time ago, and he was, I had no idea. I really respected him for his intelligence. I I'd known him for a long time. I hadn't seen him for a long time. We had lunch together, and he unloaded upon me the whole spectrum of the conspiracy theories, which totally shocked me. You know, like 9/11 was it? Didn't happen. And incredible, ridiculous. Vaccinations, even fluoride in the water was all a plot. I couldn't believe. And he had incredible fear of earthquakes. So he was staying in a hotel, but he rented a room on the ground floor so he could escape when the earthquake came. Actually, the big earthquake did come after I'd left Nepal. And he was there, but he must have escaped. He's still alive. But there is that, is that dread. I mean, I know some of my relatives who dread situations like mosquitoes, snakes, spiders and so on, which you have an abundance of in Australia. And they can't go on a picnic. They can't enjoy the outside world, which for me is a real source of pleasure, because they're scared of what might bite them. When we have people's enemies, we're thinking bad things. We think they're going to spread malicious rumours about me. They're going to say something bad. They're going to turn my friends against me. This happens with the situation of being human and discriminating good things, bad things, indifferent things. Then, of course, there's always the fear of dying. And if we're aware of karma and rebirth, there's fear of being born in the hells, in animal, as the lower realms, constant, paralyzing fear. I mean, rebirth in suffering states is taught. One reason is to generate fear. But that is a healthy fear of a potential suffering which is a reality. Now, it doesn't mean that the literal presentation, say, of the hells, is to be accepted as it is, literally. We're human beings. We can only understand pain and suffering from a human point of view. So, we know, I'm Buddha taught, that all of our experiences, our pleasant and unpleasant experiences as humans, not to mention animals, hungry ghosts and hell beings, are all coming from the mind. And that the experiences described in hell are descriptions of a potential mental misery that can happen if we create the karma for it to happen after we die. So, in other words, it is like there is no hell, physical hell, in a district waiting for us to go to. Each individual creates his or her personal hell, just as we create a personal nightmare in a dream that is totally created by our mind, but it's experienced by the person in the dream as if it's really happening. And there's real terror, real fear happens. A hell experience is a bit more than a dream. There, we no longer have a human body to wake up in. Our mind has gone beyond this life. It has a subtle body, which is like a dream body. It is something created by the mind, as is the environment. So, if we're not aware of that potential, we'll do nothing to overcome it. And we won't restrain ourselves from harmful actions towards others, other sentient beings, which will be causes for such a rebirth. So that recognition of that potential pain is healthy fear. So often you hear criticism of religious teachings as being a method invented to force people to conform to a certain code of morality. Force people. They're not true, but if people conform to the code of morality taught by the teacher, that's the whole aim of the game. Buddhism also says that we won't naturally adopt a code of morality because the power of our self-centeredness and our anger and our attachment and pride and jealousy are so strong that they will overwhelm any impulse for being benevolent towards others. So, natural adoption of a code of ethical conduct can't happen. However, as we've already explained, each new baby is born with a whole collection of karmic impressions or potencies, some virtuous, some non-virtuous. Psychological seeds, some for virtuous behaviors, generosity, kindness, love, compassion, and psychological seeds for destructive emotions, anger, attachment, and so on. So, each baby does have the potential, every baby has the potential, the innate potential, to act in a moral context or moral sense. The very cause to be born human, the karmic cause to be born human, comes from virtuous karma, mainly arising from generosity and morality, non-harmfulness. So without question, we have innate ethical potencies from past lives. So what's going to happen in the next life? Well, it depends. This is where the nurture clicks in. What sort of environment we're born into. If the ethical potential of a baby meets the environmental encouragement to not harm others, the fundamental meaning of morality is not non-harmfulness towards others through killing, stealing, lying, sexual misconduct, and so on. So if the parents are the first influences of a developing ego's sense of moral behavior. Freud called it the superego, which which modifies the innate pleasure principle for pleasure and to avoid pain, which Freud described. So there's conflict between that and the reality of external situation. You know, the baby does not get what it wants always, and often gets what it doesn't want. So the baby has to modify its innate pleasure principle through how? Through adopting the moral standards of its parents, and later on its peers and society in general and so on, but initially the parents.
Can I ask a question? Sorry to interrupt you. Does this mean then that even the parents that you get, would that also be
karmic. Yes.
Where does it?
Yes, there is. There is indeed, it's described in the text, that the particular persons who become our mother and father, we do have a karmic connection with them. We actually all have a karmic connection with each other, in general, because we've all been each other's mother and father, husband and wife, brother, sister, in past lives. But the particular parents in each life, it is described that the Bardo, being the intermediate state, is attracted. One of the reasons for being attracted to a particular parent or parents is karma. Not the only one, but partly.
So my question really is that if there are both virtuous and non-virtuous potentialities in the baby,
yeah,
and virtuous and non-virtuous potentialities in the parents as well,
yeah,
and then the combination of the two, for example, we talked about karma being one five, that the non-virtuous potentialities in the baby or the child would get suppressed because it meets an environment created by the parents who are of a virtuous disposition. So the question then arises is that, is this happening in real time, that modification, or was this modification already been put into motion before the birth? If you see what I mean, is it that, okay, going to sprout the seed of non-virtuousness, but it just so happens to meet this virtuous environment and therefore in real time gets modified? Or is it not that way? So that's where my confusion lies.
So really the question is the interplay between the child's karma and the parent's karma, the interreaction.
Happening now, or was that also predestined?
Was that sort of predestined? Or
yeah.
A bit heavy, that word.
Yes. So is the karma of modification happening right now?
Oh, yeah.
Or was it set into motion earlier?
Well, certainly, each moment of life is the here and now ripening of karmic, multiple karmic potencies, right? Virtuous and non-virtuous. And those are ripening in determined in dependence upon multiple changing conditions. And it becomes incredibly complex. Because, as we've mentioned in other talks, if the mind in general, if the flavor, if you like, of the mind is non-virtuous, right? Anger is manifesting or strong desire. That is the soil which will nurture non-virtuous karmic impulses created by anger or desire. If the mind is virtuous, that is the loving, generous, kind, that will nurture karmic potencies, positive ones, from similar mental attitudes in the past. So our attitude, our emotional state is constantly fluctuating. And we have a vast number of potencies that ripen throughout life. Now, mother's emotional state is constantly changing from virtue to neutral to non-virtue. So is father's. And so their here and now mental activity, influenced by karma, influenced by their past imprint, it's constantly fluctuating. Not to mention society, the other people around. So there's an unbelievably complexity of causes and conditions bringing about the present moment. And it's changeable. The point about morality, the whole point about establishing a code of ethical conduct, is we have an impulse to steal, for example, and we interrupt that impulse and we say, no, that's wrong, in the eyes of myself, hurt that person, we don't follow out on that impulse. So morality scores a goal or whatever, and so life unfolds in a positive way. I was talking about the child having conflict between the pleasure principle of just this innate desire for pleasure and the innate aversion to pain. Nothing wrong with that. There's no fault in pleasure, there's no fault in pain, the experience of pain, but the fault is attraction or aversion and attachment and aversion, anyway, to the experience. Another thing in the question you put forward, our rebirth karma attracts us to a mother and father who are about to conceive a child at that time. But that's at the time of conception. Mother and father are constantly changing throughout life. And they may enter a positive situation where they practice morality and they become incredibly beneficial towards their children, or they may enter a cycle of non-virtuous thoughts and behavior which make them not beneficial for their child. So that was not all pictured in the beginning. That's the here and now constant change. Okay. Where were we up to? We were talking about the problems of humans, and I think number 7, not getting what we want. So the previous problem is we're constantly meeting with situations what we don't like. And the 7th problem is not getting the things that we want and that we work for and we aspire to achieve in life. So, you know, we're desiring wealth but not getting it, fame, honor, love. So when we don't experience these things, there's so much mental grief. On top of that, desiring wealth, fame, honor, etc., but not getting them changes our grief to sobbing, wailing, and screaming. And on top of that, not getting the things we want and work for can lead to self-inflicted harm, up to suicide. That's true. Well, not only suicide, but murder, isn't it? So often we read, if somebody is rejected, then they'll kill the person. Not only will they kill the person who rejected them, but they'll kill their own children, who they created with that person. So frequent. It's just to hurt the other one, will even kill the children that we made together to hurt them. Imagine, it happens so frequently. I remember reading a long time ago, a man had a big argument with his wife, and in anger he went somewhere and got a bulldozer and came back and destroyed the family home. So irrational. Okay. Not getting what we want for induces nostalgia, yearning for past pleasures, and that can lead to depression. And the reality is that we can't experience those pleasures again. And the final problem about being a human is that our body and mind are always under the control of karma and disturbing emotions. We're carrying the causes the suffering inside ourselves, inside our mind, through attachment and aversion. Our aggregates refers to the body and mind. Then when we have those disturbing emotions, we automatically create karma for future suffering. We don't know it. We don't know if we take revenge upon our enemy that very action of deliberately inflicting harm will cause similar harm in the future. We think it'll bring an end to the harm caused by that enemy, that they'll go away forever. It will only create future enemies. You see, it multiplies exponentially the longer we live in anger and hatred. So our body and mind are vessels of the suffering that already exists, the suffering of pain, and the suffering of change, and future suffering. As we're unable to avoid attachment to pleasure, it's said, by the Buddha, that in our ordinary state of deluded, confused mind, whatever pleasure we experience, we can't help but become attached to the experience and to the object causing that pleasure, because we have the root problem, the self-centered ignorance. And whatever pain occurs because of the self-centeredness and aversion and hostility, we can't help but create the karma for future pain. The next problem, our human bodies cannot maintain any pleasure without becoming exhausted or damaged. Right? The more, there's a reality, the more we like eating a particular food or taking a particular substance like alcohol, then the more we indulge, and inevitably that will lead to physical exhaustion, physical wearing out, and physical damage. I read on the news the other day that every glass of alcohol you drink takes a week off your life. I think that was what it was, something like that. So, in general, these are just general points at the end here. Happiness depends upon conditions, causes and conditions. When those conditions depend upon the subjective karma. But when our karma runs out, we can't establish the conditions for happiness. They're out there, but we just can't get the person we're attracted to. We can't get the job we want. We just, we just don't have the karma to get what we want. And so the mind becomes miserable, unhappy, and angry. It can't be happy, and there's this vicious circle of spiraling into this unhappiness, anxiety, depression, and anger, and that drives people we want to be our friends, it drives them away. We crave friendship, we crave love, but our self-centeredness pushes the potential beings who can give us friendship, who can give us love, it pushes them away. So, that is the eight particular problems that we all experience in this uncontrolled state of mind. It's not saying it's inevitable. Of course, the solution is the path. That's the fourth noble truth. So we've got to come to that. So, all of these problems that we've listed summarized into the three types of suffering. The first is called, literally, it's called suffering of suffering, or the suffering of change. And this really refers to contaminated happiness. So it's referring to what we call happiness. And that means happiness which is experienced by a mind contaminated by ignorance. And it's not just ignorance of not knowing reality, it's the self-grasping ignorance which clings to the mistaken impression of a truly existing self, an inherently existing I. So, whenever we experience pleasure, then there is a sense of I am experiencing this truly existing pleasure. So, our pleasure is a type of happiness, and it's described as like the relief of pouring cold water over a burn. Right? The burn is really painful. We put cold water on it, we say, oh, what a relief, that's so nice. But the pain is still there. It's just a lesser degree of pain. And the relief will not last long. As soon as we stop pouring the cold water, the pain comes back. So, similarly, as it says in the notes, the pleasures of satisfying our hunger through eating, our thirst through drinking, our desire for physical touch, particularly the embrace of another's body, or the pleasure of just lying down, these by nature are just a type of relief. They don't induce lasting pleasure, lasting happiness that doesn't go away. The craving, the hunger, the thirst, the exhaustion, the desire for sexual pleasure will come back. And it will be craving for it to have it again and again. Even, as it says, when we're enjoying a meal, then if we hear bad news, that will destroy that pleasure. The food, no longer can we taste it. So this is what we call the suffering of change. Our ordinary happiness is suffering of change. It's only a type of relief. And because there's the self-centered ignorance, grasping truly existing me, then we concretize the experience as a real true me experiencing this real true object, and this happiness is real true happiness, pure happiness. It's not pure, it's contaminated. It's temporary relief. The situation will inevitably change, and the craving, the desire, the hunger, the thirst will reemerge. Technically, in the classification of things into suffering of change, this also includes the objects that produce those feelings, the tastes, the sights, the music, you know, the sounds, the touchables, those sensory experiences, the objects, and also the whole mind itself is suffering of change. Now, there is a happiness which we can experience which is not the suffering of change. So, as it's in the notes, you know, unlike the pleasure of nice tasting food, which does not get better all the time, in fact, the more we eat our favourite food, another mouthful will be like so objectionable, you know, we might explode like the fat man in Monty Python. Seen that film? Anyway, he explodes when he eats the chocolate afterwards. All right. But there is a happiness that does get better all the time. A stable mental happiness of love, of genuine love. of genuine compassion, of generosity and wisdom. When we give with a mind uncontaminated by self-centeredness, we might still have self-centeredness, but it's not manifest. It's not like giving a present to someone, I'm the great benefactor, I hope they really appreciate me in giving them this money, you know, or whatever it is. But just genuine wish to give somebody something, or a hungry animal some food, delighting in their pleasure. That is happiness. That is love. And the subjective joy in giving won't go away. It doesn't fade. If it's genuine love, even the person insults us and says, that's not enough, I want more. Doesn't matter. From our side, our mind was pure. So that happiness, that peace of giving with a non-self-centered mind, that lasts, that increases our self-confidence, a genuine sense of self-esteem, which helps us to do so much more. If self-esteem is based upon craving reciprocal reputation, or something, we want the object of our generosity to reciprocate properly, then we won't have that lasting happiness. So there is happiness which is not suffering of change. And this quote from Mark Twain, which I have already mentioned in these talks here in Singapore. Mark Twain, a remarkable person. I don't know a lot about Mark Twain, but his book, a very short book called Captain Stormfield's Visit to Heaven, it's fantastic. If you could get a copy, it's only very small. And Captain Stormfield, he dies and he gets reborn in heaven, and he meets an old timer who shows him around heaven. And all of Captain Stormfield's preconceptions about heaven are a little bit changed, but it's so good. It's such a good tour, and you can see the insights into our simplistic belief in heaven as being such a pure place. So the man who's showing Captain Stormfield around heaven, he's saying, no, heaven is not this place of pure unending joy. He's and happiness. And so he says to Captain Stormfield, you see, happiness ain't a thing in itself. That's a profound Buddhist teaching. It's only a contrast with something that ain't pleasant, like the happiness of pouring cold water on a burn. It's still painful, but we say it's pleasant. But it's only the contrast with the greater pain that you were experiencing before. So that's all it is. There ain't a thing you can mention that is happiness in its own self. It's only so by contrast with another thing. And so as soon as the novelty is over and the force of the contrast is dulled, it ain't happiness any longer, and you have to get something fresh. I showed this to a friend of mine, English monk, Steve Carley, I think he's been here. And he said, boy, the Buddha could have said this. It really is. It's teaching emptiness of things existing in their own self and so on. It's quite amazing. Okay, that's the first type of the three types of suffering. Second is the suffering upon suffering. So this is where one problem is followed by another. And the example is we've got that burn, and instead of pouring cold water on it, if we rub it, the pain's only going to get worse. It's real pain, right? So this is the physical pain or mental unhappiness that we all recognize as suffering. You know, unless we're, you know, a masochist, we all recognize real physical pain and mental unhappiness as suffering. And as with the previous type, when we're talking about suffering upon suffering, it's not just the feeling of pain or unhappiness, it's the whole mind. So whatever is manifest with that unhappiness, that is suffering of suffering. As is the object which is causing that physical pain or that mental unhappiness. So, you know, this broader view of suffering is that the world is suffering. The world of painful objects is suffering of suffering. The world of pleasant objects, the pleasures of beautiful sights, sounds, smells, tastes, and so on, touch, those are the suffering of change. So this is a very Buddhist way of looking at the world. When I say Buddhist, I say Buddhism so often gets, criticized for being a fairly pessimistic view of the world. Well, it's not pessimistic. It's reality. And it is proposing a solution. The next two, the third and fourth Noble Truths. The third is the suffering of, literally, conditionality. When we have a burn, we don't pour cold water on it, and we don't rub it. It's just there, and it's hurting. So this third type of suffering is like, it's just there. And this means, in essence, it's a suffering we're always, in our ordinary state, we're always under the control of our karma and our disturbing emotions. We don't know what karmic potencies we have. We don't know the strength of our seeds of selfishness, anger, attachment, pride, jealousy, but they're there. We have no free will. It's such a philosophical debate about free will. From the Buddhist point of view, I don't even know what the philosophers define as free will. But certainly, from the Buddhist point of view, whilst the lack of free will is the suffering of conditionality. And why do we lack free will? Because we have all of these disturbing tendencies, karmic and psychological, to suffer. So, lack of free will. The implication is that we can achieve free will because the causes of karma and afflictions, the root cause, is self-grasping ignorance. And by training our mind in the wisdom, seeing reality, we can destroy the root cause. And then when we do that, not just intellectually, but actually this will come very much in tomorrow's talk when we talk about the path. The practitioner reaches on directly realizing reality, he or she destroys the karma. All the accumulated negative karma is extinguished. Cannot ripen. Not saying it disappears, but it's like you have seeds of wheat or rice, and if you burn them, the seeds are still there, but they lose the potential to germinate. So similarly, the wisdom realizing emptiness burns our negative karmic seeds. They cannot germinate. So that attainment of the wisdom directly realizing emptiness, that is your first moment of free will. Not totally free. Because although you'll never ever again create negative karma, and you won't suffer again, you don't have total freedom because things still appear to exist inherently. It's not a problem, it's not an affliction, but it's an obstacle to achieving Buddhahood. So you still have to, the Bodhisattva still has to eliminate those final the false appearance before they become a Buddha. Then a Buddha is totally free. But really, you can say that upon realizing emptiness, you have this freedom, because you will only take rebirth through choice, through compassion, through wisdom, in order to continue your path to enlightenment. You choose. You're not born under the influence of karma and afflictions, so you have the power to choose your parents. You know, we all were karmically attracted to our parents. I was. I mean, some of you may be Arya Bodhisattvas, I don't know, and you chose your parents. But this is how beings, you know, like Lama Zogchen Rinpoche, His Holiness Dalai Lama, they can choose their parents out of seeing a situation where it will be beneficial to reborn in a particular family and continue their practicing of Dharma, of practicing of bodhicitta. I don't know how we got onto free will, but do you get the point? Yeah.
You're saying that if you don't have the wisdom directly, you're an emptiness, then you have no free will.
You can still, your decisions can be, how do you say, they're not determined. You can make new decisions. We have lived, our mind.
Thinking of this earlier example, someone going to the mall, right? He got a choice to go or not to go. If he go, then he got shot, then he's karma.
Yeah.
Like if he don't go, then it's free will. You have to choose. Am I not right?
Well, it depends why you don't go.
If
well, when we talk about the freedom of making a decision, we're talking about making a decision which is not determined by karma. In our decisions in life, karma is just one condition. Karma refers to our experiences in life. Decisions come from other mental factors. They come from mental factors of knowledge, correct knowledge, incorrect knowledge. Yeah? We can have deluded ideas about things. And things we do in life can very much be deluded or influenced by anger, attachment, pride, jealousy. Knowledge can be accompanied by benevolent purpose and so on. It is possible to have clairvoyant awareness, for an ordinary person, to have clairvoyant awareness of what might happen. So if you have the clairvoyant, and that's a type of wisdom. So if you have clairvoyance, knowing that there's a dangerous situation, you avoid it. I'd say that's free will. In that particular decision. If you have not generated wisdom realizing emptiness, and it's possible to have clairvoyance but not the wisdom realizing emptiness, you're not totally free. You're still under the control of karma and afflictions. Okay? Right. Think about it. Well, in the notes, there's a bit of point, there's some points about samsaric birth and so on. Now, samsaric birth is inseparably connected with karma and afflictions, the conditions for suffering. And the suffering is not the feeling alone, pleasant, unpleasant or neutral. It includes the entire body-mind continuum associated with that feeling. Now, this last sentence, due to the power of wisdom being enhanced by bodhicitta, upon attaining the path of seeing, so that's when a bodhisattva generates the direct wisdom realizing emptiness. So, at that point, bodhisattvas abandon the contaminated aggregates and they achieve a mental body. So what does that mean? That means that the meditator, through the power of achieving that direct realization of emptiness, the body and mind which they were born with as a result of karma and afflictions ceases to exist, and they achieve a mental body. So, to ordinary people, when that meditator comes out of meditation, they will look the same. We ordinary people will still think it's the old friend who went into meditation. But to somebody else who has that level of realization, is it the, equal or higher level of realization, they will see that the body and mind is a mental body, that this has come through the power of wisdom and compassion. They will know it. Do you see what we're saying here? The whole environment that appears to our ordinary mind, it says here, is suffering of suffering. It is suffering of change. The product of karma and afflictions. The environment, as well as the subjective experience of the environment. So our world is our karma. Even there is a slight difference. Each one of us sees things in the street, sees events from a subjective point of view. There is a common element in our experience, like this room is a common element, but the subjective experience depends upon each of our individual karma, and it could be different, but it is different. Not only that, whether our mind is virtuous or non-virtuous, that changes our subjective experience. I've been using an example. You live in a certain road or street, and it's just an ordinary street. For your mind, feels ordinary, nothing special. But you have a date with a boyfriend or girlfriend, and you fall in love. And when you come home, the street is very different. It's beautiful, flowers blooming, birds are singing. It has a totally different street, according to your subjective mind. Next day, she or he rejects you. You're totally depressed, miserable. You come home, and the street is ugly, unclean, not nice. There's nothing pleasant at all. So, the street we live in depends upon our mind. So for the individual, you can't say, what's the real street? There is no real street. Every street we live in, every person we meet, is the way we experience them is dependent upon our fluctuating karma and mental state. There's no real world out there as we see it. There is external reality, but it's not as we see it. Okay. bodhisattva, meditating, ordinary body looks ordinary to everybody. During that meditation, a bodhisattva directly realizes emptiness, that body changes into a mental body. A mental body is where that means that there is a physical body, the primary cause is wisdom and compassion in this context. Not karma and afflictions, wisdom and compassion. Now, ordinary people, they still see their karmic projection of you as an ordinary human being. Like the Dalai Lama appears to us as an ordinary human being. But somebody whose mind is at the same level of realization or higher, they will see a mental body and they will know that this person has directly realized emptiness through the appearance. Now, I don't know what the appearance is. I have a very mundane projection. So that was just the point I was trying to get across. Oh, it's even written here. Mental body. This body of the meditator is no longer a true suffering. Right? It's not the first noble truth because it's not created by karma and afflictions. The definition of a true suffering is that which arises from karma and afflictions. So this body of the meditator now is not a basis for suffering or creating negative karma. Cannot. Can't experience negative karma, can't create negative karma. If the Theravadan practitioners who don't have bodhicitta, they don't train their mind in bodhicitta, they realize the same emptiness, they have the wisdom realizing emptiness, but it's not supported by bodhicitta. So they, a Theravada, the point of this is that if you are following the Theravada path, you do achieve the wisdom directly in realizing emptiness, but you don't achieve a mental body until you achieve nirvana. So an arhat, a Theravada arhat, does have a mental body, but not before that. Whereas the bodhisattva, due to the vast accumulation of merit through bodhicitta, achieves a mental body earlier on. Still, the Theravada practitioner does not create negative karma after realizing emptiness. Yeah? Between which and karma? Universe. Oh, yeah. If we take on karma, you see. So. The influence of karma on free will.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now my question is on that. Let's say my common sense tells me not to do like this, but somehow I have a strong, very strong connection with this. So there's a conflict between my decision
and as I say, I'm experiencing the suffering of old age and I'm going deaf, especially with the machines going. But if we have a karmic tendency to do something, but we overcome that, we decide not to follow that impulse or that karmic urge. Is that we're saying? Is that free will or? Yeah. Why the practice of the eight precepts? Yeah.
Because
Yeah, undoubtedly, any virtuous activity, especially taking precepts, is very powerful. The purpose is to purify negative karma, to accumulate positive karma, as well as enhance our virtuous mental qualities of love, kindness, compassion, generosity. And this does lead to self-determination, the ability to have a degree of free will in overriding karmic impulses to do something, and as well as impulses arising from selfishness, attachment, jealousy, anger, and so on. So, yes, those virtuous practices give us the opportunity to take limited control over our destiny, if you like, or over our life. Not total, because we only achieve total control over karma when we have the direct realization of emptiness. Is that? Okay. So tomorrow, I mean, we'll finish these outlines, but a big topic is the fourth noble truth, the true path. And there is this diagram that is available in the notes, and a lot of that is a really important diagram. That is the true path. And so for quite a lot of the time tomorrow, I want to explain this diagram. So if you have it with you on a tablet or in the notes, it'll be really helpful. And hopefully, yeah, I'm pretty sure, the explanation of the true path will tie it all together. Okay. So as we did that meditation this morning on generating loving kindness for all beings, independence from mother, father, and so on, then following up upon that motivational meditation, then remembering how we set love to all sentient beings all around us in the form of light, the collective positive energy of thinking about and discussing Dharma today, may this ripen for their benefit by my actually generating universal responsibility for the welfare of all sentient beings and becoming a Buddha, so that I can put that universal compassion into practice. Thank you very much for being here.